The following is a Bhakti Yoga Retreat, Session 2, Srimad Bhagavatam, 1st Canto, Chapter Number 5, Text Number 10, given by His Grace, Sriman Sankarshan Dasadhikari, recorded on July 12, 2014, in Vail, Colorado, USA.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Na Yat Vacha Chitra Pradam Hare Yasha Jagat Pavitram Pragrinita Karhichit Tat Vayasam Chirtam Ushanti Manasa Na Yatra Angsha Niramanti Usik Chaya Nayad Vachastita Padang Harir Jasho Jagat Pavitram Prajanita Karhichit Tadvayasam tirtam mushanti manasa Nayatra hangsha niramant yusikshaya Nayad vachas chitra padang harir yaso Jagat pavitram pragranita karhichit Tadvayasam tirtam mushanti manasa Nayatra hangsha niramant yushikchaya Na not yet that vacha vocabulary chitra pradam decorative Hare of the Lord, Yashaha, glories, Jagat, universe, Pavitram, sanctified, Pragranita, described, Karhichit, hardly, Tat, that, Vayasam, crows, Tirtham, place of pilgrimage, Ushanti, think, Manasa, saintly persons, na, not, yatra, where, hangsa, all perfect beings, niramanti, take pleasure, usikchaya, those who reside in the transcendental abode, Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Those words which do not describe the glories of the Lord, who alone can sanctify the atmosphere of the whole universe, are considered by saintly persons to be like unto a place of pilgrimage for crows. Since the all-perfect persons are inhabitants of the transcendental abode, they do not derive any pleasure there. Purport. Crows and swans are not birds of the same feather because of their different mental attitudes. The fruitive workers or passionate men are compared to the crows, whereas the all-perfect saintly persons are compared to the swans. The crows take pleasure in a place where garbage is thrown out, Just as the passionate fruitive workers take pleasure in wine and woman and places for gross sense pleasure. The swans do not take pleasure in the places where crows are assembled for conferences and meetings. They are instead seen in the atmosphere of natural scenic beauty, where there are transparent reservoirs of water nicely decorated with stems of lotus flowers in variegated colors of natural beauty. That is the difference between the two classes of birds. Nature has influenced different species of life with different mentalities, and it is not possible to bring them up into the same rank and file. Similarly, there are different kinds of literature for different types of men of different mentality. Mostly the market literatures which attract men of the crows categories are literatures containing refused remnants of sensuous topics. They are generally known as mundane talks in relation with the gross body and the subtle mind. They are full of subject matter described in decorative language, full of mundane similes and metaphorical arrangements. Yet with all of that, they do not glorify the Lord. Such poetry and prose on any subject matter is considered decoration of a dead body. Spiritually advanced men who are compared to the swans do not take pleasure in such dead literatures, which are sources of pleasure for men who are spiritually dead. These literatures, in the modes of passion and ignorance, are distributed under different labels, but they can hardly help the spiritual urge of the human being, and thus the swan-like spiritually advanced men have nothing to do with them. Such spiritually advanced men are also called manasa, because they always keep up the standard of transcendental, voluntary service of the Lord on the spiritual plane. This completely forbids fruitive activities for gross bodily sense satisfaction or subtle speculation of the material, egoistic mind. Social literary men, scientists, mundane poets, theoretical philosophers, and politicians who are completely absorbed in the material advancement of sense pleasure are all dolls of the material energy. They take pleasure in a place where rejected subject matters are thrown. According to Sridhar Swami, this is the pleasure of the prostitute hunters. But literatures which describe the glories of the Lord are enjoyed by the Paramahamsas, who have grasped the essence of human activities.
Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Jatapada Kamalam Sri Gudun Vaishnavamsha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vidam Tam Sajivam Sadaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Badam Sahagana Ladita Sri Vishakam Vitamsha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nivishesha Shunyavadi Paschanjade Satarvine.
How true it is indeed. These mundane literatures, they may be described in decorative language, full of mundane similes and metaphorical arrangements. There's so many fancy poems out there, fancy song lyrics, fancy, you know, all kinds of sophisticated movies and novels and dramas, you see. They're very attractive to the mind, but they have no benefit. Just like there was that poem, the very popular poem in the U.S., the Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. It's a story of the poet is sitting in his room at midnight, and some bird comes and sits outside his window. he sees the bird as some kind of a mystical messenger or something. But it doesn't really say anything, you see. But it's very fancy poetry. We had studied in school, you know, this is one of the great American poets, Edgar Allan Poe. We had to study and worship these great writers. They had such great realization. You know, that's how we were taught. And then rejecting that, then there was all the other countercultural poets, you know, like Bob Dylan songs and this and that. So many things. And they go, oh, it's really cool lyrics. But there's nothing there. If you really look at it, there's nothing there. It's just some fancy words, that's all. It's fancy metaphors and similes. But there's nothing really there that can connect you with your actual self. And see, the problem in our present civilization is we're disconnected. We're not actually tuned into ourselves, our true natures. We're misidentifying with these material bodies. And that's insanity, actually. It's an insane condition. What is this body? It's destined to get old, get sick, and die. But is that your nature? Do you want to get sick? Do you want to get old? Do you want to die? These miseries which are being forced upon us by the modes of material nature are completely incongruous with our actual identities. But we're told, well, don't worry about it. You just got to take the good along with the bad. Just got to, you know, accept it. Well, that's how we're taught. You got to take the good with the bad. But no, you don't have to. You do not have to take the bad. I mean, actually, I said it backwards. You have to take the bad with the good. You don't have to take the bad with the good. You don't have to. You don't have to identify with this rotting, aging body. You don't have to do that. You're not required to. Difficulty is we're programmed that way from the very beginning. What's the first thing we heard when we came out of the mother's womb? Oh, look, it's a boy, it's a girl. You see? We're immediately taught that I'm the body. Immediately, the first thing we hear in growing up, be a good little boy, be a good little girl, you see? We're programmed into thinking, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, and my enjoyment is to enjoy in a certain way, as a boy or a girl. You see? But how does that help you at the time of death when you have to leave behind that boy or girl body? You see? What has it done to actually prepare you for a life of bliss, all this bodily consciousness? So we need to hear from enlightened beings who have seen beyond the concept of this body, who've actually entered into that transcendental dimension where life is eternal, full of knowledge, full in bliss. We need to hear from such people, you see. And because of that hearing from enlightened spiritual beings, as we studied last night, by hearing these messages from realized souls, we become realized. Doesn't take some Herculean effort. Even a simple child can do it. You simply have to tune in and hear. And that's all you got to do is tune in. Tune in and listen. But even that becomes difficult. The way we're trained by television, especially, is constantly, they have to throw all these different, you can't just focus on one thing. It has to be this image, that image, a whole barrage of this, so many images. You see, you can't just focus in. The intention span now is very short. But what was the attention span of the sages of Naimisharanya? They were prepared to pay attention to one thing, a yogi, to hold off the influence of Kali for 1,000 years. They are prepared to pay attention to one particular subject matter for 1,000 years without breaking their attention. You see? If we can go for 1,000 seconds, it's a miracle. Mm. So in the path of bhakti, this is something we have to learn. It's how the art of how to pay attention, how to keep our attention focused on one thing. You see, even in the other yoga systems, they do the same thing. My first attempt at self-realization was a correspondence course on Hatha Yoga. And the first thing they had me do was sit down and stare at a candle flame to learn how to keep my mind on one point. Of course, it was rather dry. I mean, how much nectar you can get out of a candle flame? You know what I mean? I ended up taking the candle and burning all the lessons, because I could see it didn't work. You see. But still, the concept of paying attention, you see, is there. And we'll be studying that in more detail in the next session, the different types of yoga. So, how do we then get absorbed in this activity of hearing from realized devotees? How do we do that? How do we master that art? How do we, drag ourselves out of this, the bedlam of uncontrolled minds and actually get fixed up, you see? That hearing is the key. Prabhupada gave himself an example. He's the perfect example of a good hearer. Prabhupada, was a pharmaceutical businessman. At that time, he was a Bhaichandande. And he had met Bhaktisiddhanta at the rooftop at Uttadanga in Calcutta back in 1922. And he had immediately accepted him as his spiritual master. So Prabhupada said, practically, he initiated me. I mean, he immediately took shelter of him as his spiritual master, even though there was no formal initiation. He immediately took shelter of him. This is my guru, you see. And he was always meditating on him. So he didn't get initiated until 1933, but prior to that, perhaps 1932, the chronology I have not read, when he went to Vrindavan, when Guru Maharaj Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was taking the devotees on Vrajmandal Parikrama and giving and lecturing on the science of bhakti. Anyway, in the evening time, we know when we go to Vrindavan, what is the big thing in the evening for the Vrajabhasis? Darshan. You go to Krishna Balaram, you go to Bunki Bihari, you go to Radha Raman. You go for darshan in the evening. It's the big thing. Instead of the nightclubs and the cinemas, the Vrajabhasi nightlife is darshan. So anyway, now they hear there at Vrindavan, it's evening time, it's darshan time. Bhakti, but you can go to hear the lecture by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. But how is he speaking in very, very erudite English? The materialistic demeanor cannot possibly stretch to the transcendental autocrat. And so many big sophisticated words that even we English native English speakers have to get out an unabridged dictionary to figure out what he's talking about. What to speak of some Bengali villagers who hardly know English at all. So how many of them actually went for the lectures? A few sannyasis, and that's about it. They all went for darshan except for one pharmaceutical businessman from Allahabad named Bhaichandande. He said, I would understand or I would not understand, but I would go on listening, you see. I would go on hearing. And just like in our ISKCON movement, when somebody is getting initiated, the temple of, getting ready for initiation, the temple authorities recommend to the initiating guru, we recommend so-and-so for initiation. So the same thing in the Gaurima. They recommended, the devotees from Allahabad recommended to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, there's this very nice gentleman of Bhaichandande, we'd like to recommend him for initiation. He said, oh yes, the others go away, but he hears. Therefore, I'm accepting as my disciple, you see. So that is the qualification. If you actually want to be accepted for initiation by a bona fide spiritual master, you may think, well, I don't have a college degree, or, I'm not very affluent, I'm not very intelligent, I'm lusty, I'm angry, I'm greedy, I'm envious, I have all these snake-like qualities. How can I become qualified to actually become a disciple? Well, that's it, hearing. hearing, 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 hearing. So Prabhupada said, because I heard nicely, now I can speak nicely. So if you have a desire to do some incredible welfare work for the benefit of the suffering souls of this planet, to help revolutionize this world, to make a global, you know, upliftment of consciousness with your life, if you want to be part of the solution and part instead of the problem, part of the problem, then the key is to how you can become a part of the solution is hearing. You hear, hear, hear. Whenever there's an opportunity to hear from advanced Vaishnavas, hear very nicely, absorb it, learn, take it deep into your heart. Because that's what made Prabhupada, that's what he said empowered him to be a preacher, a giver of this transcendental wisdom in a very powerful way. And we can do the same thing. We can do exactly the same thing. But where will we hear? You see, we can hear from the mundane poets, the mundane novelists, or we can hear from the Vaishnavas, the swans. The swan is a very interesting example that is used in the Vedic literatures. It's very much ingrained in our Sanskrit literatures. The pure devotees are called Paramahamsas. They're called, which is, means supreme swan. So it's a very, very, very much ingrained in our Vedic literatures, the simile of the swan. So what is it about this? Why the swan? Why not the duck? Or why not the, you know, the giraffe? I mean, why the swan? You could ask. The swan has a very special beak. You can give the swan a mixture of milk and water, and he can extract the milk and leave aside the water. Is that it? Yeah. So what does that mean? You see, the Paramahamsa, even within this material world, what is he sucking out? He's sucking out Krishna. Wherever the Paramahamsa goes, he's connected. He can experience Krishna in that place, whether it's the city, whether it's Denver, whether it's Vail, or wherever it is, Calcutta, Johannesburg, wherever it may be. You see, New York City, the Mojave Desert. He can go anywhere and everywhere and extract Krishna. And this same point is actually made in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a verse, Bhakti Parashanu Bhavaraktirya Nyatrachayatrika Ekakalaha. It's a very nice verse. This verse says three things happen when you actually advance in Krishna consciousness. Number one, you develop loving feelings for Krishna, bhakti, you see. Number two, you experience Krishna within everything. That means through your smelling, through your seeing, through your hearing, through your feelings, through your thinking, you gradually learn to be able to experience Krishna everywhere and everything, you see. That's because Krishna actually is present within everything. He's within every sight, within every sound, within every aroma, within every sensation, within every thought. Krishna is actually in there because it's all coming out of him. He's the source of everything. Nothing can exist except, even a thought that's in your mind cannot exist except it's there because of the energy of Krishna. Nothing exists outside of Krishna. Outside of Krishna, there is nothing. Everything is there within Krishna, so Krishna is within everything. So, through this process, one actually learns to experience Krishna everywhere. And then the third item mentioned, the verse Viraktir means no more interest in sense gratification. Because once you get the higher taste, who needs the lower taste? Now, if I were to give you $1 million right now and say, here, I'd like to give you $1 million. Wow! Great, $1 million. Now give it back. I wasn't really serious. You have to give it back now. Oh, I thought you'd give me $1 million. No, but actually, I'm asking it back. I'm going to give you something better. I'm giving you $1 billion. Oh yeah, no problem. Take the crummy $1 million. Give me the billion. You see? So what we take to be $1 million here, all the pleasures of the material world, they're just some crummy, cheap dirt in the street compared to Krishna consciousness, you see? Even if you had the greatest opulence, the greatest power, the greatest position, the greatest prestigious situation in the whole material world, which is to be Lord Brahma, the demigod in charge of the whole, this whole universe. What does Krishna say? A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartin Arjuna Mam Upechita Konteya Punar Janaman Vidyate. From the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest planet, wherever you go, it's all miserable. It's just dirt. It's junk. It's garbage. The whole place. You say, wait a minute. This is my precious. You can't say that about my precious Rocky Mountains or whatever. I think it's very special. Actually, it is. It's just miserable. There's no pleasure to be had in this material world. Do you think there's some pleasure to be had here? Think again. There is no pleasure to be had in this material world. Forget it. Finished. Why do we think it's pleasurable here? I'll tell you why we think it's pleasurable. Because anandamaya vyasat, our nature, we are enjoyers. You can't deny it. We want to enjoy it every minute, unlimited happiness. You can't take that nature away from yourself. Therefore, if you don't find it to be pleasurable, you pretend that it's pleasurable just to somehow get by psychologically. That's what it is. Just like there was a novel written by Richard Farina back in the 60s. I didn't ever read the book, but the title was very significant. The title was, I've been down so long, it looks like up to me. I see. So this material world is such a rotten, miserable place, but we want unlimited nectar at every minute. So if we don't have it, we imagine that this is nectar here. We just imagine it's nectar. Because we can't imagine being in a place where there's no happiness. Therefore, we have to imagine this is happiness. It's called Maya Sukaya, illusory happiness. Because our actual nature is we have unlimited pleasure at every minute. If we don't get it, we have to imagine that we're getting it. Just to somehow, you know, not want to go out and commit suicide in the next 10 minutes. You see? So actually, Krishna consciousness is psychologically the psychological necessity of every single living entity in this world. And they're just going on in some artificial state of imaginary happiness right now, which will prove to be a failure in due course of time, unavoidably prove to be a complete failure in due course of time. Therefore, instead of being disappointed, we should take advantage of the messages of these great realized devotees and actually come to that transcendental platform where we can experience Krishna at every minute. We can be connected with the supreme superstar at every minute. The material world, everybody, if the superstar is there, everybody likes to go, oh wow, I was on the airplane and I sat down there and there was Mick Jagger. You tell all your friends, wow, or Paul McCartney. I sat down on the airplane, and there was Paul McCartney, and I flew with him across the Atlantic. We talked about all kinds. You tell all your friends, I met a superstar, you see. I got to shake hands with President Obama. Or, you know, everybody's attracted to some big personality. It's a natural tendency we have. So why not connect with the supreme superstar of all the superstars, you see, Krishna. The other superstars are shooting stars. They're a big star today, and tomorrow they're forgotten. They vanish into oblivion. Here today, forgotten tomorrow. Why not become an intimate associate of that person whose power, beauty, renunciation, knowledge, wealth, and fame will never be equaled or excelled by anyone in all of eternity? Why not connect with that person, become an intimate associate of that person, and relish the sweetest nectar, the most enlivening enthusing adventure at every minute. You see, that's called Krishna consciousness. That's called Krishna consciousness. You think Krishna consciousness is a bunch of rules and regulations? No, it's not. Krishna consciousness means to connect with Krishna in a loving relationship. That's what it means. I know the first devotees I met, and I very much appreciate how they preached to me, but they were very sincere, but they didn't turn me on. Of course, I wasn't really ready either. But maybe it was a combination of the two. But it was like my first impression of the Hare Krishna people was like, you know, boot camp for the Marine Corps. You know? And I wasn't quite ready for that. You know, I'd actually, they called me up to fight in Vietnam, but all our countercultural heroes had taught us how to resist, you know, the draft. And I, you know, I'd been trained up by so many songs by the countercultural songwriters, ward protesters. And they called me down to the induction station. I was able to successfully beat the draft using a few tricks. And, you know, my loyalty was not to go over and get killed in Vietnam and shoot a bunch of Vietnamese people. That wasn't my idea of what happiness in life was. So, now I forgot the point I was making. What we have to understand is that this material existence does not give us any satisfaction. We may think we can get satisfaction out of it, but there is no satisfaction. It's just like Prabhupada gives the example of a mirage in the desert. It may appear to be very nice. I'm dying of thirst. Oh, look at that water out there. It's fantastic. Let me go for that water. I saw one time a painting. It showed a man in a business suit running full speed into the desert. It's a very, very appropriate photograph. He's running full speed into the desert for nothing, you see. So this material world, we're running full speed into the desert, going after so-called happiness of material life. And there's nothing there. We're disappointed by it. So instead of being fooled or befooled by the propaganda of the materialists, we should actually find out, who am I? What is the purpose of my existence? Why am I here? This was the realization I had when I hit my freshman year of college. I'm sitting there and the dormitory, you know, I've been kicked out of the nest of my boyhood home, my boyhood bedroom. You know, I kicked out of the nest. Now I'm out in the collegiate world, sitting there in my dormitory, preparing for my career. But I didn't know who I was. Who am I? What is the meaning of my existence? They want me to decide what is my major. How can I decide on a major? I don't even know who I am. It didn't make any sense. You see. I need to know who I am first. What is the purpose of why am I here? Why do I exist? But the teachers couldn't give that answer, you see. The Vedanta Sutta tells us that Tato Brahma Jigyasa. You have to, first of all, your duty in the human life is to realize what is the absolute truth. What is actually true? What is absolutely true, you see? Now, some people argue, wait a minute, there is no absolute truth. Don't be a naive simpleton in thinking there's an absolute truth. You have to understand there is no absolute truth. I mean, don't be carried away with some fanaticism of thinking there's an absolute truth. But we have to ask them, are you absolutely sure there's no absolute truth? Yes, I'm absolutely sure there's no absolute truth. I just caught you, sir. You just defeated your own self by logic. You can't be absolutely sure there's no absolute truth, because that's an absolute. So the fact that that absolutes, you cannot negate the existence of the absolute, proves logically that there must indeed be an absolute. You see, you can't negate its existence. It's impossible. It cannot be negated. There has to be an absolute. So what is it? Is it? Do they teach it in the university? No. The University of Texas, they have a big thing on the tower building, which is where all the students commit suicide during finals. They jump off the tower. Not all of them, but some of them. It says, know ye the truth, and the truth shall set you free. It's actually a quote from the Bible, from the old days, before religion was kicked out of the universities, you know. But it's a quote right out from the Bible, right from Jesus Christ. It says, know you the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You ask a professor, what is that truth will set you free? It'll set me free. He can't tell you. And if he does know and he tells you, he'll lose his position. It's God. One of our members, he was a student at the University of Texas, and the professor said, you know, students, you know, it's really cool. You should have, you know, you should have boyfriends and girlfriends both, you know. You can have sex with boys and sex with girls, you know. Have fun. Bisex. Enjoy bisexuality, you know. You can have boyfriend over here, and you know, have your heterosexual girlfriend over here. Enjoy. Students, enjoy. He was telling him in the classroom. He was encouraging him to have sex with boys and girls, both. You see? He was encouraging bisexual. Did he lose his position? No. But if he talked about God, all men immediately would be kicked out, you see. So this is the state of our modern civilization. And it's bewildering. It's a very bewildering situation. I was thinking there as a freshman in the college, well, here I am working hard. I was made the dean's list regularly. I was one of the top students. But I was thinking, here I am working hard to make good grades, to get a good degree, to get a good wife, a good job, a good house, a good car, some good kids, and what? A good coffin. A nice coffin. Buried 6 feet under with some really nice flowers once a year until they forget about me. What's the point? What am I working hard for doing this for? Doesn't make any sense, you see. Doesn't make any sense. Why am I here? Why do I exist? You see, I need to know these things. You see. We had one course called Basic Studies. It was the pride and joy of our professors. It was an interdepartmental course that we all attended in a big auditorium. A professor from one department one day, another department, and we'd study the whole gamut of Western civilization. Of course, what are the initials for basic studies? BS. It was a campus joke. Yeah, BS 101. Got to go up for BS today. BS 101, BS 102. But in all that BS, we never got any light. We studied all the great philosophers. Actually, we found out that our civilization, this wonderful civilization, is cradled in the wonderful home of our culture is what is now called Baghdad. That was our whole culture is coming from Baghdad. That's what we learned, the Tigris and Euphrates civilization. And then the Greeks came in and the Romans came in. And we studied the medieval philosophers, the Renaissance philosophers, the existentialist philosophers. But no one could ever give any answer that made any sense as to why we're here, why we exist. Not one philosopher could say why we exist, why we're here, you see? The academic world is not equipped to do this. You need a realized spiritual master, you see. You need a realized spiritual master. And you need wisdom, Vedic wisdom, you see. The Bhagavatam describes a realized spiritual master as that person who has realized the conclusions of the scriptures by deliberation and is able to convince others of those conclusions. That is the bona fide spiritual master, according to the Bhagavatam. So these scriptures are compiled by great liberated personalities who can see past, present, and future, who actually know where everything where everything comes from. What is the basis of reality? Why does reality itself exist? They know, understand all these things in full detail, and they can enlighten us in these things so that we can actually become reconnected with our actual natures. So this is what we have to connect with. We have to leave aside all that garbage, and we have to connect with the essence of existence, not the coverings for those who wish to be deluded and thinking that they're the center of the universe. You see, the covering energy is there, the material energy is there for persons who are envious of Krishna. Don't want, you say, well, why envy of Krishna would come if it's so perfect and so beautiful? Well, that's part of the beauty of it, because it's not forced upon you. You understand this point? If it was forced upon you, you had to be a devotee of Krishna, whether you like it or not, then you're a prisoner. But Krishna gives everyone the free choice, love me or leave me. Because we have that choice, therefore, it's mathematically probable that out of an infinite number of living entities, there will be an infinitesimal number who will misuse that free will. It's bound to happen. If you have an infinite number of living entities, and you say, that, what are the odds of one actually misusing their free will? You can say, well, it has to be the smallest possible number, which is 1 over infinity. So if you take 1 over infinity and multiply it by infinity, what do you come out with? My God, infinity. So therefore, we have an infinite number of living entities in the material world who misuse their free will. You see? So it's mathematically quite sensible that you would have living entities who misuse their free will. It makes all sense in the world. You will have some people who leave them spiritual room. So there's some papers passed around rather late. We're ending in 5 minutes. But, oh, there's a question. Great. What are dreams? Dreams are a collage of images which have been stored in your subconscious from this life and previous lifetimes that come up kind of like they come swirling up and they kind of spin around in your psyche. These are dreams. It's a collage of images that kind of, an image from here, an image from there, an image there, they just kind of merge together and swirl around and come up with some concoction. So they're not very important. Last night I dreamed I was a cashier in a store. I was shot twice by 2 thieves, flesh wounds. It was very real. Can you explain? Even seeing things in movies, you can dream them. You see, you may have seen a movie where somebody was a cashier in a store and he was shot by 2 thieves. Maybe you saw it on CNN, you know, one of these... So all of these images are there, and they come up and they swirl around when you dream. They're not very significant. But if you dream about Krishna, that's very nice. Or dream about Prabhupada, or dream about devotees, it's very nice when you dream about devotees. You're actually coming out of the dream of material existence when you're dreaming about Krishna conscious things. So if you're troubled by such dreams, and I would certainly be troubled by such a nightmare, the key is increase your Krishna consciousness during your waking hours and be prepared for some really sweet dreams that will gradually come. Some really nice dreams. It'll be so nice you'll hate it when the alarm clock goes up. Wow, that was really a great dream. I was there and Prabhupada was there, or Krishna or whatever, you know. If I'm taking guidance and hearing from a self-realized soul, and I'm an individual with my own conditioning, how will hearing a general instruction help me? Do I not need deeper help? This is an interesting thing. Because it's we we hear from our Srila Prabhupada that one should take the order received from one's spiritual masters, his very life and soul. Well, some of us got direct personal instructions from Prabhupada. Just, I got a few. He told me to always be enthusiastic, for one. That was one of my favorite. And he says, he told me to always be enthusiastic, and if I did so, I would get Krishna's blessings. It's a great order. But many devotees didn't, especially who joined later on, they didn't get any direct instructions from Prabhupada on a morning walk, a darshan, or in a letter. They didn't. So what about them? Are they somehow out in the, left out in the cold? They're out in, those you joined after Prabhupada left, are you out in the cold? No. Because the general instructions are just as personal as the personal instructions. In other words, Prabhupada got a direct instruction from Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakura to spread this movement in the English language. And he gave a general instruction to all of his disciples. Actually, he said American and European disciples, because we didn't have any Indians then. Practically, the only Indian we had in the beginning, you know who he was? Prabhupada. We had one Indian. It was Prabhupada. And we were all American boys and girls from the hippie movement, practically all of us. Prabhupada said the hippies were our best customers. We were all hippies. We all the brahmacharis had these incredibly long sikhas. It was amazing. How was that? Because we had hair down to our waist. And we shaved up. We had these long, immediately long, long sikhas. Prabhupada got the order to spread. But Prabhupada told all my American and European disciples, you become perfect in understanding the science, you become guru, and you deliver the world. So is that any less personal of instruction that he gave from the Vyasasana in Los Angeles to all of us, addressed to his American and European disciples as a group? Is that any less personal than Bhakti Siddhanta telling him you should spread spaces of consciousness in the English-speaking world? Is it any less personal? No, it's not. It's a misconception to think it's less personal. It's a misconception. You see, it's a misconception. So there's, you don't, the those general instructions are just as personal. Of course, if you need personal help, fine. In fact, when I joined, I had a question of Vishnu Janaswami. He was my Vartma Prasarshaka guru. He was our leader at the time in Austin. So I had a question. He said, well, I don't know, why don't you write Prabhupada? Wow. I liked that. It was a great suggestion. Write Prabhupada. So I did. And I wrote Prabhupada a few more letters. And then there was a policy that came out. Prabhupada is feeling difficulty to answer all these letters from all the devotees. And Prabhupada's policy was, you should let from now on, you ask your temple president, your GBC, and the sannyasis, and they will write me. Whew. But I tell you, I mean, I felt that need, really strong need. And I really took a big risk, and I wrote Prabhupada. Because I really wanted that contact with Prabhupada himself personally. Just, you know, my neophyte stage, I just really felt that need. And I wrote him, and Prabhupada was very kind to me. He reminded me of the instruction that he had given, you know, you ask your temple authorities, your GVC sannyasis, and et cetera, because I need time to do my writing. But then he gave me a loophole. He said, but if there's any urgent need, I'm always happy to hear from my beloved disciples. Oh, wow. It's not just some corporate thing, you know, corporate policy. No, it's a loving father. Wow. This melts your heart, you know, when you think about it. Here he is straining, but still, if there's some disciple who has an urgent need, lay aside his translation work. Yes, what is your problem? How can I help you? You see. So I did have an urgent need as a young devotee, I admit it. I wrote him a letter for a couple of three years. I wrote him regularly. But after that, I matured a little bit. I wouldn't say that, I matured a little bit more. I didn't need to do it. And I felt very good. I knew Prabhupada's feeling for me as a loving father. And I didn't need to have him, you know, be pounced on his knee like a little baby anymore. I can take those general instructions as being just as personal as the personal instruction, you see. So the spiritual master will do that. He'll give personal instructions to help you connect. That's his compassion. How does one know the difference between whimsical inspiration and inspiration via Krishna's guidance? That's why we have senior devotees. That's why we have gurus, why we have sannyasis, why we have temple presidents, GBCs. We have more experienced devotees who help us to know the difference. I think we should save these because our time is up, and we can save these for the next session.
We have some time.
Huh?
We have some time.
Yes?
We have some time.
We have a little more time?
Yes.
How much more time?
Like 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay. We'll do that. I got enough questions here, so we'll do it. Yesterday you said that our mission is not even taken. Oh, it has taken off, but it's hardly taken off compared to where it's going to be in the future. You said our mission is not taken off. Hare Krishna is not even counted as a mainstream religion. Do you feel that this is because we shun all academic? Academia is simply interested in proselytizing? No. In other words, why haven't we become more successful? That would be the question. Are we too much into proselytizing? We're not academic enough. Actually, we do have devotees in academia now, by the way. We have, Garuda Prabhu. He's a PhD. He's presses academic. Academically acceptable and glorified presentations of Vaishnava philosophy. We are in academia. We do have devotees in academia. It's not that we don't. We don't shun all academia. Prabhupada met with many academics. And proselytizing, of course, that word has very, very bad connotations. Proselytizing. It means you're like beating, you're taking the Bhagavad Gita and beating him in the head with the Bhagavad Gita. Oh no, you surrender, you rascal. Boom, boom, boom. Well, see, I also felt in the beginning that it was like a proselytization. I didn't respond to proselytizing either. It was like, as I mentioned earlier, joining the boot camp. Now we're getting to where I left off, where I forgot earlier in the lecture. And I was so averse to how devotees are preaching to me. I would even argue with them against the philosophy. I thought that it was a proselytizing thing, and I was turned off by proselytizing. I met one devotee in the campus. I said, on the Berkeley campus, I said, you Hare Krishnas, I like the chanting, I like the prasadam, I like the devotees, but when it came to philosophy, I thought they were just proselytizing. So I told the devotee, I said, you Hare Krishnas, you say that your senses are imperfect. So how can you realize Krishna with imperfect senses? I was showing a fallacy in their philosophy. And the devotee, of course, now I know how to defeat the argument, but the devotee, he went, couldn't say anything. The answer is given by Rupa Goswami. Atakshi Krishna Namani Nama Vengrayam Indriyai Sevan Mukhehi Jivado Svayamai Vasparat Yadaha. You cannot realize Krishna with your blunt, materially contaminated senses. It's not possible. You cannot do it. But by engaging your senses, jivado, beginning with your tongue in the service of Krishna, you become Krishnaized, spiritually saturated, and with transcendentalized senses, you can realize Krishna. So if that devotee had known the answer, he could have defeated me, but he didn't. He was a new devotee, and I defeated him. Thought I had defeated him. I didn't really defeat him because Rupa Goswami was standing behind him. And I wasn't really, I thought I had defeated him, but I really didn't. So the point was, finally I met one devotee who I really came across not as a proselytizer, and that was Vishnujana Swami. Instead of saying, you got to follow these rules and regulations, it was His move was, give your love to Krishna and taste the nectar. Just give your love to Krishna. Experience the nectar. He's so beautiful. He's so wonderful. That approach, you see, that really appealed to me. And that's that we, it could be possible that we are too much in a mood of proselytizing even now. We haven't learned how to preach more effectively. I don't think it's, I wouldn't say it's because shunning, we don't shun academia. We are willing to talk with academics. We are willing to even, we have, you know, but I do think we need to learn how to become, come off nasas. We do have to become more and more expert in attracting people to Krishna consciousness, attracting them to that all-attractive person, Krishna. I do see that. I know I was interviewed by some devotee in one temple for something he was going to put on the internet, and his question really turned me off. This is going to be put out for the public to help for preaching. He said, and this is the kind of questions he asked me. He said, why do we wear tilak? Why do we go to the temple? It was like rules and regulations. He wanted me to explain all the rules and regulations to the people. That's not how you present Krishna consciousness to the general public. We are immature in our, I've seen that to some extent nowadays, even still. We have a tendency to present this as a sect, as a religious sect, which is not. This is the essence of existence itself. I was challenged by, my wife and I just finished a little preaching tour of the Fiji Islands a few years back. We were standing there at midnight at the Nandi Airport getting ready to catch a flight to Los Angeles on Air Pacific. It was a big, huge queue, economy class, a big, huge queue. It would wait forever to get through the line. And finally we finished it, and then some man came up to me with a big grin on his face. He saw me there with my tilak and my robes. Now I'm going to defeat another one of these proselytizing religionists, you see. He said, what's your philosophy? He thought he had me, going to smash me immediately. I looked him right in the eye and I said, know who you are and be who you are. Couldn't say anything. You have to know how to present Krishna consciousness, not as a sect, as a science of realizing the self. You have to learn how to, every devotee has to know how to do that. This is not a religious sect. This is not Hinduism. We're not trying to make people Hindus. We're trying to help people actually realize who they actually are. If I told you, you know, right now you're suffering because you don't even know who you are. You're suffering in amnesia right now. And I actually have a technique, a method, where you can actually realize who you really are and achieve unlimited opulence. Would you be interested to hear about that? You see what I'm saying? We have to learn how to present this scientifically, not as a sect. It's very important. It's very important. If we're going to take over the world, as Prabhupada ordered us to, we have to learn how to preach. We have to learn how to attract people to join, to come to hear our... there should be 10,000 people when we have meetings, you know, when we have seminars. We should have 10,000 people coming. Why only 50 or 60 people? Why not 10,000 people? Why not have to get the big athletic stadiums? When the Beatles came, they filled up Shea Stadium with screaming fans. Why we can't fill up the stadium with 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people to hear about Krishna, you see? We have to learn how to do that. We haven't mastered that, are you? You see? So we do have to learn how to come across not as proselytizers, but as well-wishing friends who can actually bestow the greatest blessing upon others by helping to realize who they really are. How important is it to count beads when chanting? Yesterday you said only 16 rounds should not be a goal, but to chant at all times. The counting is actually important. Prabhupada ordered us to count on the beads. It's coming down from the Goswamis. It's not some concoction. It's there in our scriptures that one should chant on the beads. And Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he chanted on beads when he did his, what was it, 10 million names, some big thing he did to prepare himself for his preaching mission. This counting is very, it helps us because this way at least we get a certain amount of chanting done, a minimum done. They say, well, someone says, I'm not going to chant the beads, I'll just chant as much as possible throughout the day. They won't chant that much. Bottom line is, they won't chant that much. To actually get sufficient amount of chanting done, you need to count them. Why 16? Well, when you leave the office, leave your home to go to the office, do you make sure your mobile phone's fully charged up? Or do you just give it a 10-minute charge? You charge it all night, or you charge it for 10 minutes before you leave? What's the smart thing? To charge it all night, right? So you get up, you don't have to worry. You're not going to go dead in the middle of the afternoon when that important call comes in. It's not going to go dead. So 16 rounds is a full charge of your consciousness for one day, you see. 16 rounds is a minimum charge. You can charge it more if you want, but 16 is your minimum charge for a day. So it's important to make sure you're charged up. Just like, why do you have a meter on your smartphone that shows you how far you're charged up? To make sure you fully charged it. So the counting is our meter. To make sure we've charged up sufficiently. My sister is a devout Catholic. I was trying to explain the concept of the Trinity. I did not know what to say other than that Lord Krishna is God the Father. Jesus is God the Son, and the Holy Spirit is the Paramatma. Can we... Let's see... Can we still appreciate nature? Yeah, actually, I was thinking of that. Here I was really relishing the beautiful scene, even though there was some obstructions there, relishing the beautiful mountain scene. And even Prabhupada mentions here, the swans are interested in places of natural beauty where there are transparent reservoirs of water. I was going, yeah, that sounds really nice to me. Yeah, that's natural. Anybody who's in the mode of goodness will naturally appreciate nature. And there's no harm appreciating nature. We can use that. It's like we came here to Vail. Why not have it in Denver? Because it's beautiful out here. And we're attracted to it. So why not use that as a nice setting place for transcendental topics? The sages would do that. They'd go to the forest, you see. There's nothing wrong with combining the sattvic attraction to nature with transcendental, because sattvic guna is the platform, is the launching pad for the transcendental platform, you see. So the beauty of nature is not in itself sufficient. It's a mode of goodness. But it is a good platform from which to go to the next step. So we can use this nature as a platform, appreciating nature. Is it necessary to have deities in the home? Prabhupada didn't tell all the householders to have deities in the home. He preferred a householders to live near the temple and come worship in the temple. Now, if a householder is away, then you know it's not practical to go to the temple, then that's another thing. They can have deity worship at home. But bear in mind that Radha Krishna deities, Jagannath Baladev, Subhadra, that's a higher standard. If you want to, if not practical, but you come to the temple regularly, of course, if you already have the deities, whatever you have, do it. Keep doing it. I'm not telling you to change anything. For those who don't have deities, think they may want to get deities, they can't come to the temple, Gaur-Nitya is recommended. Because you can't make any offenses against Gaur-Nitya. They don't accept any offenses. But especially with Radha Krishna, that's a very strict standard. You know, bathing and dressing every morning, Mangal Arti on time every morning, bathing and putting them in their night clothes at night. Radha Krishna is a very high standard. If you already have, then you're not doing that, then raise your standard. But it's not necessary. I recommend for my disciples, for example, just have some photograph. I mean, don't take on more than you can properly manage, and make it a farce. You see, I'm going to get deities, and then, you know, a month later you're not waking up to have Mangala Arati anymore. It doesn't make sense. If you want to get deities, you should be regulated to rise every morning and have Mangala Arati. Then deities would make sense. Otherwise, get some photographs. Have really nice. You can make it very beautiful. Like, this is a nice little temporary altar. You know, it's nice. It gives the nice flowers. You can make a nice altar without having to have deities. Beautiful photographs, nice decorations. You can make it very nice and inspiring. When I joined the movement, the temples didn't have deities. Our temple in Austin, I'll explain our altar for you. We had a little black and white cutout this big it was a cutout from Bhakti Gadhead magazine, a black and white cutout of Panchatattva. It was that big, and that was our altar. And we were completely enlivened, totally enlivened with that little photograph. That big. Of course, we had Vishnu John Swami there too. That helped. And his kirtans, Prabhupada said they would carry to Vaikuntha, and they did. So yeah, you don't have to have deities in the home, but if you do want to get deities, be committed to a very regulated program of rising early. But the best thing is go to the temple. If you have Gornatai deities at home, you can leave them aside to go to the temple. That's the advantage of Gornatai deities. They won't mind if you leave them aside and you go to the temple, you know, on weekends or something like that. So this is a very general question. I have significant. Admit, I can't really answer every specific situation, but I've just given a generic answer. There may be variables according to your particular situations. But I've given a generic, kind of a general understanding. Yeah.
It would be advisable if somebody wants to have a deities in their home, they should inquire take the permission from their spiritual master.
Yeah, if you have a guru, it's better. The best thing, ask your guru and let him. Take your guru's instruction, and then that worship of your deity now, it becomes connected with your spiritual master. It becomes very nice. Okay, this is the last one. Wonderful class. Well, I'm trying. But actually, because you're wonderful hearers, and I'm inspired, it's your wonderful hearing that actually gets the credit here. You're wonderful hearers, and I thank you very much. From today's verse, I think of two important points. One, you came across the pure unalloyed devotees like Srila Prabhupada, and second one is the right scriptures. Okay? Otherwise, there was no hope for all of us. Yeah, you have to have, the scripture has to be bona fide and the spiritual master has to be bona fide. If you have those things, then you're in good shape. If the guru is bona fide, of course, if the guru is bona fide, he's going to give you the bona fide scriptures. If he gives you a bogus scripture, he's not a bona fide guru, obviously. And if the scripture is bona fide, then it will tell you how to find a bona fide guru. So either you can come in either way. Some people directly meet a devotee and get inspired. Some people read the book. Wherever you come, through the medium, a devotee, a guru, or the book, there's three things: sadhu, guru, and shastra. These are the three platforms of Krishna consciousness. Just like photographers know, a tripod will hold your camera steady. One leg or two legs won't. Some photographers use a unipod, but you have to hold it also. A tripod is a steady platform for a camera. So we have our tripod, Krishna consciousness tripod. These three things will make you steady in Krishna consciousness. You have guru, you have sadhus, and you have scripture. All three bona fide, then you're solid. So we have Prabhupada's books, we have Prabhupada and as the guru of all of us, and we have our individual gurus also. When we get initiated, those of us who joined after Prabhupada's disappearance, we take initiation from one of the gurus in the line of Prabhupada, you see. And that connects us with Prabhupada also, formerly as initiated grand disciples of Prabhupada, you see. And then, so there's the scriptures. We have Prabhupada's books. So we have Prabhupada's books, we have Guru, we have Sadhu and Shastra, those three things. If you have all three, then you become very solid and you become very steady. So if you're feeling unsteady right now in your Krishna consciousness, then you need to see, well, maybe I'm missing one or two legs. You see? You need those three things. You need scripture, you need devotee association, and you need Guru. Those three things you need. And if you have those three things, you become, we say in Hindi, pakka. Or in Sanskrit, nishta. You become nishta, fixed up. Okay, we'll stop here, and we're looking forward to the next prasadam coming, and there'll be another session coming up soon. We thank you all very much. On the schedule, it says, what is it, next session at 10:30?
Yes.
Huh? 10:30? We're giving out a little prasadam to help you get kickstart the breakfast here. Everyone come for a little prasadam. Jantarad Srimad Bhagavatam ki.